Ansari. Sheikh Ansari, he was the greatest, he was the biggest marja of his time, marja at-taqlid. That means he was a scholar who was, all the people were following his methodology of lifestyle based on his jurisprudential rulings. At that time, there were, of course, when he left the world, there were three scholars. One of them was Marfum Haj Mirza Habibullah Rashti, and another one was Marhum Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari. Both of them are very great scholars. Mirza Habibullah Rashti had hundreds of students, and he would teach them, and he was a powerful scholar in jurisprudence and law. And then we also had Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari, a very, very powerful scholar. He himself also had hundreds of students under him, until 300, some of them say. And he was a powerful scholar, yet he was a very humble man also. There are stories about him that will surprise you, that this Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari was such that when, despite having all these students and everyone knew that he is the greatest scholar of his time, yet when Sheikh Ansari comes to Najaf, the same Sheikh Ansari who passed away, when he comes to Najaf, he tells him, he and himself, and tells his old students to learn from Sheikh Ansari, because he found Sheikh Ansari to be more knowledgeable to him. Anyways, at that time when Sheikh Ansari passed away, we had Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari, Sayyid Mirza Habibullah Rashti, and we had another scholar called Sayyid Mirza Hassan Shirazi. These three scholars were the ones that were present after Sheikh Ansari.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when Sheikh Ansari left this world, he was the source of guidance for all the Shias. But when he died, we had three scholars, three experts in jurisprudence, or we call here in Shia terminology, marja al-taqlid. That means the center of obedience in terms of following them based on the rulings that they extract from the teachings of the Prophet and the Holy Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So now these three scholars sat down and they decided that for the sake of the unity of the Shias, instead of there being three scholars who are the centers of guidance, we have one center of guidance, and therefore two of them would vote in benefit of one, so that only one becomes the leader. And from all of them, the youngest was Sayyid Mirza Shirazi. And Sayyid Mirza Shirazi comes to them and tells them, look, we need to choose one person. That person who is very intelligent, who is clever, who is pious, who is a scholar, who has learned well, who has studied properly. And he should have insight. He should be able to look far, to be able to see the problems of the community, to see the future of humanity. Okay, in this Islamic society, we need a scholar like that. So the two other scholars who are older to him, who are elder to him, told him that Mirza Hassan Shirazi, you become the leader. You become the center of obedience and center of authority. For now, we trust you. And he was surprised because he was younger to them, and even according to himself, he felt that he had lesser knowledge than them, but they trusted him and they gave him the authority. Look at the way our leaders were, that instead of fighting for leadership and forcing leadership upon amongst themselves, they were in fact ready to give it to others, because they knew that the leadership here means a divine authority that needs a stamp from a divine source, and therefore this is a very important thing. It's not just a mere small issue that can be discussed and just, fought about in a simple manner. No, it is something that needs to be clearly, thought about and then applied in the society. this was how things were. Inshallah, we will discuss more about this issue and the discussions that we had regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam's statements in Nahjul Balagha in the sessions to come. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
And many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 5th. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power. The National Zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porcupet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend contests solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic
skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zora is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is, but I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zora says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zora had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zora says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be? In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat, and a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahanabad has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir, this allowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here, and every day I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare Philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office. In the age of technology, electronic mail, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر الله اکبر خمینی رهبر الله اکبر
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the great soul of Imam Khomeini, may God bless him. And with me to discuss deeper insights into the character and personality of Imam Khomeini is, of course, my good friend Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, an Islamic scholar and academic. I'd like to welcome him to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
In previous sessions, we've talked about polarization of the Imam, which meant that, you know, haq and batil, truth and falsehood, if you're on the path of truth, you're bound to have enemies. And we covered that. Now we're moving on to something very interesting. And I think our listeners are going to be a little bit, I don't know, they're going to be sort of half and half about this, but it's a very, it's very interesting what you're about to say to us. But let me begin by saying that in Surah Baqarah, in chapter 2 of the Holy Quran, we have a passage regarding hypocrites. And it's quite lengthy. The Lord God does say a lot. And quite rightly so, it does say in the Holy Quran, from the Holy Quran, that there is a quote that says that when the enemy, the hypocrites, are with the believers, they say, La ilaha illallah, you know, you believe in the one God that you believe. And when they're with their own shaitans, right, because of course, Imam Khomeini referred to the U.S. as the great Satan at that time, And when they are with their Satan, they say, no, we're with you, which makes a lot of sense, even in the 21st century, because we know. So, but you're going to turn around and say something entirely different, because, of course, this is in the context of believers that, you know, not all are believers. There are those who simply pay lip service, but really they are with the kuffar. Their hearts and minds and souls are with the kuffar. So I'll let you quite nicely quote from the great Imam, and take us from there. What do you mean by this?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, you know, we were thinking about, okay, so we have these, everybody's excited and there's agreements and everybody's
all
talking.
Sorts of things, yes.
And you know, we've done a program on it as well. You know,
we
analyzed it. You know,
because
agreements are good. Nobody's against talking.
That's just the way we are. That's what we do.
Right. You know, the same kind of line that Imam taught us, which is that you are rational. You talk. This is in the context of, you know, people talking and, you know, agreements being made and everybody being
happy.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that's all
exciting stuff. Yes.
Right. And we've done programs on. We did a program on it. You know, where we analyzed it.
We always analyze
the
great game.
We're not naysayers.
Yes.
We're not. You know.
No, we're not. No, we're not naysayers. I don't have a crystal ball.
Right. And so the point is that there's this sentence from Imam,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, it's one of those,
yes.
you know, one of those sentences
mm-hmm.
where you're like, okay, cool, now I get it. And I'm going to give you the basic translation
please,
of it. It's
please.
Like, you know, it's not the exact word for word
sure.
translation. He says, even if America and Israel said, La ilaha illallah,
yes.
we wouldn't believe them.
We wouldn't believe
them. Because they just want to fool us.
Yes, because I would have thought, you know, being a believer or being in part of the Muslim Ummah, that would be a wonderful thing if I heard that America had said, La ilaha illallah. Because, you know, on a low-level basis of faith, I would have said, well, you know, it's converted to Islam or something. But you're talking about something entirely different.
Right, which is what another characteristic of Imam, which I want to talk about.
Exactly.
We talked about his fearlessness. Remember? Before
exactly,
we did. We talked about his ability to really distinguish haq from batil, which,
exactly.
you know, if you want to call it polarization, but we would call it something that he really is able to...
Yeah.
You know, distinguish haq from batil. Part of that, or another aspect of that, or even something different from that, is just his ability to distinguish who's a munafiq.
Exactly.
Who's lying?
Who's lying? Who tells us,
you know,
lies?
Who's trying to fool you?
Exactly.
Okay. This is a big problem that we have
within
believers and religious people. Is, you know, we try to be good. We try to have good.
Or try to do things in good faith.
We try to have good assumptions about people.
People,
and
yes.
you know, we'd say, well, you know, they must be good. Or, and yet, we see, and you know, you see the same thing with the Prophet, peace be upon him. Again, you see
yes.
the same thing with the Imam.
Very good.
With Imam Ali alayhi salam, you see it with the Imams.
Yes.
They are able to distinguish the enemy. They are able to distinguish who is trying to fool them. They can distinguish who is, you know, saying things out of nifaq, out of hypocrisy.
Because
okay.
it's very interesting what you're saying, because even if we put it in a historical context, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, at all times tried to give the enemy a way out, if
right.
I can put it that way.
Okay.
And we had treaties which allowed the kuffar, in a way, to repent, in a way, to find salvation.
Right.
Right? He even said, okay, you don't accept me as a prophet, then fine, just cut out my name from... piece of paper.
The preamble.
Thank you. But what happens? We see that down the road, although everything was done in good faith, the other side cannot maintain it. And we realize that because, you know, somewhere down the line, they renege.
Right.
So basically what you're saying is absolutely true, because there's a precedent for this. And it's true. We have deals. We have things happening. It excites us. Yes, wonderful. But you're right. There is caution.
Right, and it has to do with the fact that a believer
mm-hmm.
shouldn't be simple-minded about things.
Exactly.
That's the point. Okay,
yeah.
The point is not that the fact that you're trying to be a good ethical person doesn't mean that you, you know, become simple-minded and not realize who the enemy is and who the... and at the same time, because, you know, I'm mean, I want to be clear about this. You have certain movements. You have this idea of you know, which is now Supreme Leadership, you know, coined the phrase, he said, heroic flexibility, right? It's not about being, you know, just a, you know, one-track, stubborn, you know, you have to have flexibility. You have to try to, you know, try to do things in a way that gets you to your goal.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
But at the same time, not be simple-minded about things. You know, when he talked about the heroic flexibility initially, he used the example of a wrestler where, you know, a wrestler might bend and twist in order to what? In order to win the battle.
The battle, yes.
When he's doing this...
Win the competition, yeah.
Win the competition. When he's doing this, he's aware of who is against him. He's not, you know, there for you know, coffee and cake.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I think what I'm trying to point out here is that you have a person like Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, and then as a successor, Ayatollah Khamenei. And you can see that one of the distinct features of real Islamic leaders, which again, in its greatest manifestation, you see in the Imams and you see in the Prophet, is being able to distinguish, you know, people who are trying to fool you.
Exactly.
Distinguish who the enemy.
Mm.
Not being fooled by certain words of the enemy, which might have an emotional appeal to you.
Exactly.
Like you said.
Mm.
Wouldn't it be great? Oh, suddenly, you know,
my God.
Right?
Yeah.
How are they going to try to fool you? They're not going to try to fool you by cursing you.
No.
Right?
Right.
You, when you're trying to get something from somebody, which is not your right, which is whatever, I'm saying, you know, let's just give an example of not you, me, okay?
Yes, yes.
Well, you try to, you know, ingratiate yourself, you try to do things that they like, you might even, you know, you try to be like them.
Yes.
So that they will be like, oh, you're just like me, okay, here you go.
Yeah.
But it's a lie. It's not real.
Yeah.
So there, again, and you know, this is why Imam, you know, this is why he's a great person. Why he's a great leader.
Mm.
This is why people love him.
Mm.
Is because you have a cleric, a Islamic scholar who's supposed to, you know, be happy when somebody says La ilaha illallah.
Exactly.
Right.
That's a very good point.
You know.
Absolutely.
And he's
absolutely.
Like saying even if they say the one thing which is the
core
of my belief.
Of my belief. Yes.
Of what I'm trying to say, which is Tawheed, which is you know, there's no God but Allah. Even if they say that very sentence, which is the core of my being, I'm not going to be fooled by it. And this is a problem that we have among the believers.
We do.
Okay?
Mm.
Is that we get fooled too easily.
Mm.
Okay? Whether it's, you know, the direct enemy that's you know, we're opposing, the one that really doesn't want us to be around, or whether it's, you know, trying to compromise with, you know, whatever.
It's very interesting.
People or movements or groups which, you know, in the end, they really don't believe in what you believe.
Exactly. I'd like to take a small example just to to take our argument forward. And this is real. This has actually happened.
Mm.
In the UK, at this moment in time, all Muslims are under surveillance. They're under surveillance by MI5 and MI6, the intelligence services of the UK. In what way do they carry out their surveillance? Well, you get a couple of officers, police officers, posing as Muslim converts.
Right.
They go to the mosques, they pick up on some Molana, some, shall I put it, some scholar, if you like, an Imam Masjid, who they think is pretty vocal in what he has to say during the Jummah Khutbah, during the Friday sermons. And they pick up on this, and they say, this guy looks like he could be trouble. So they go over, they say, well, you know, it's very interesting what you have to say, and things like that. We love that, and it's very interesting. And they try to build a relationship with this person. And down a few months, they decide that they're going to convert to Islam. And, you know, the Imam Masjid becomes very happy. He says, well, you know, all you have to do is say, La ilaha illallah. And there you have it. And they've got the beards, they've got the silly little cap, and you know, what we talked about, the caricatures of Muslim. They do that. And you know what happened? 6 months down the line, that Imam Masjid is now in jail. Because they asked him questions like, what's your take on jihad? Do you think it's the right thing to kill British soldiers in Afghanistan? Questions like this.
And, of course, you know, his answers didn't go down too well with those officers, so they persecuted the family. They actually built up a huge case. It went to the Old Bailey, and the guy's now facing, I think, it's like a 10-year prison sentence, or
right.
maybe even he's probably off to get more. So, you know, this is the thing. So what you're really saying there is very powerful, because the Imam, may God bless his soul, is really pointing us out, don't be naive of the enemy.
Don't be naive. Don't be naive.
And that's a real example.
Right. And
it's
not about that, you know, somebody who has, you know, has good assumptions about other people is a bad person.
Yes.
It's just there's a difference between, you know, that and somebody who is a leader of a community or somebody who has a responsibility for others being naive.
Yes.
If you're just in your own life and you don't have family and kids and you're just living your you're living in your own little, you know, apartment somewhere and have nothing to do with people, whatever. I mean, okay, maybe your naivete is just going to harm you.
Yes.
But the point is, when you have, you know, governments, when you have, you know, societies, when you have Muslims who have responsibility for others, they can't be naive. They can't. And, you know, I'll give you another example.
Please.
Because we've talked about this.
Yes.
The Turkish leaders.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah, so we haven't
now
spoken
it's not
about
like
them.
It's not like, you know, Hillary came and said, la ilaha illallah, but, you know.
Yeah, she was close to it.
Right, so I mean, it's like, just use your brain.
I know.
You know, all this history and all these things, because, you know, we recently had the Supreme Leader, you know, mentioning, giving us a little short history of what America has done in the region and to Iran.
Sure.
You know, just to balance things out a little.
Yes,
of,
I mean,
know,
he did point out that they actually slaughtered something like 4 million natives.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about also even.
Yeah, yeah.
You
but
know, yeah, that is a whole exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
That,
I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, let's get
its own story.
Let's get things into perspective.
What they did in their own so-called, you know, so-called own country.
Own country,
own country,
in inverted commas.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, why would you believe a government, people, you know, statesmen, stateswomen from you know, America, Britain, France, you know, Israel, with that history? And you read the Quran.
Absolutely.
Okay? Like, you know,
yeah, it's crazy.
Everybody, you've read the Quran.
Yeah.
I know you've read the Quran.
Yeah.
You know,
what did you get out of
Dr.
it?
Dr. Yeah. I know you've read the Quran, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but, you know.
Did you understand?
Did you understand anything of it?
Right?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it?
Why would you rely on the Americans? Okay? And worst of all, because, you know, we're like, so what do we do about, you know, because that's clear. And, you know, it's not simply munafiq. It's not simply an issue of being munafiq.
No.
They're not munafiq. They're not saying.
Yeah.
You know, they're not saying we're Muslim, you know.
No.
What I'm trying to point out is that, you know, this sentence by Imam, again, you know, even if America, if America and Israel, even if they said la ilaha illallah, we wouldn't believe
them.
You know, don't be swayed by these emotional, you know, actions of other people. Use your brain, step back for a second, think about the essence of the of who's opposite you. Think about their nature. Think about their history.
It's very important.
Okay? Think about who is standing in front of you. You know, don't get caught up. This is how Shaitan, you know,
does his work.
Fools you.
Fools you. That's exactly what
okay?
he does.
You go that line, which is the line, you know, the Sirat al-Mustaqim. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to curse them immediately right there in front of them. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, behave in an irrational manner or in a rude manner, even to the enemy. Know who the enemy is. So, you know, I just wanted to point that out about Imam, that very, very precise understanding of who the enemy is. This is on, as it relates to enemies, you know, outside of the Islamic world or of the Muslims or even outside of Iran. Another example of what we're talking about and what I'm talking about is how he was able to understand those people within the revolutionary movement who were a danger.
Very good
and
point.
Who might have said la ilaha illallah.
Of course.
But who didn't believe it.
No.
The greatest example being Munafiqeen organization.
Exactly. Because they were looking for their own benefit and their own power in the country.
They were using Islam as
a tool to get to where they wanted to get.
To, you know, play with the emotions of people who are religious. But in reality, it was just a cult.
It
was like, you know, let's just have these two people. I don't even want to mention their names.
No.
Okay? Because...
No, it's not.
They're just, they're, you know.
No.
They're not worthy of...
Yeah, I can see their images just
it's
now.
Not even
no.
They're not even worthy of being mentioned.
No mention, yeah.
Right? Mm. And it's basically, you know, brainwashed cult.
Yes.
Okay? And from the very, we're talking, you know, way before the revolution, where the revolutionary movements had begun, you know, in the 60s.
Sure.
You had these efforts by these groups like Munafiqin and others to try to get some sort of, you know, some sort of credibility by being associated with Imam.
Yes, exactly. And to become popular.
Right.
And a populist
through
movement.
Through their, you know, get a kind of quote-unquote blessing from Imam.
Yes.
And he refused to give it to them.
Because he knew their nature.
He knew that they were not
what
Muslim.
They say they are.
They were not La ilaha. They didn't believe in La ilaha illallah. When they said La ilaha, they didn't believe it. This is why they're called Munafiqin.
Exactly. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Right.
This is what we were referring to in Surah Baqarah.
Okay.
That's the whole point. Yes.
Because they asked him, you know, in the 60s, are we allowed to give of our homes to certain movements in the revolutionary struggle? And he forbid it.
He forbade it.
He said, don't give it to them.
No.
They're not. Their goal is not Islam.
Islam.
Okay.
Marshall.
That's on the left and on the Marxist or whatever.
Yeah,
you
they were.
On
I mean
that
we found out later
on the
what
on
they
the
were.
More liberal side of things. Mm. He stood firmly against, and we've mentioned this before.
Sure.
Those organizations which had the claim or the mantle of religiosity, you know, the nationalist religious groups, the freedom movement, whatever, you know, who came from a liberal. Even to a certain extent, conservative social background, you know, middle class, upper class,
sure.
Who basically were trying to go that kind of liberal conservative Western model for Iran.
Yes, exactly.
Not the Marxist model.
No, the
so
Western
and they said, well, you know, as Iranians, we are also Muslim, and you know, we pray and whatever and all that. Okay,
yeah.
So it's not like they were not, you know,
practicing Muslims
right?
or religious,
but they were extremely naive.
They were.
In the sense of like, well, let's try to come to a deal with the Americans. You know, at the time of the revolution, it's
that's
not even
right.
It's not even now when we're powerful
yes,
and where we have, you know, where we have 100 things that have happened in these 35 years.
Yes.
Like, give us the ability to go sit there for, you know, months on end and negotiate and come to a deal that
sure.
that we like and that benefits us to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It's at that time when we were just passed through being their slaves, and now suddenly they're like, well, you know, let's so. And you see Imam standing very firmly saying, even though that you are Muslims and you say La ilaha illallah, and again, we mentioned this example in the previous program, the issue came about Islamic laws.
Yes.
Especially as it
that's
relates
right, we mentioned this
especially
before.
As it relates to criminal offenses.
Yes, yes.
Being implemented.
Mm.
Which, you know, that's what you do in an Islamic government.
Exactly.
You know, that's exactly.
That's
part of Islam. You can't, you know, pick and choose.
Choose, exactly.
You know, I like the prayer part. I don't like the part about executing, you know, a person who's killed, you know, a whole family. So that's part of Islamic law as well.
Exactly.
You can't pick and choose it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's even ayat in the Quran talking about you take one part of the Quran.
Yes,
and
exactly,
the
and choose another. You're going to do like what Bani Israel did before?
Right. So a lot of Muslims do that, unfortunately.
I know they do.
And I'm not saying, maybe I do it myself as well. I don't know. I'm just saying that you're not supposed to do that. Okay? The point is, so the minute you have these people who, you know, pray, fast,
mm-hmm.
all the things,
right.
and then they're like, oh, if we do Islamic laws as it relates to criminal offenses, this will be against the Charter of Human Rights, Human Rights Charter of the UN. You know what Imam said. He said anybody who denies Hudud, the
is a kafir.
Is a kafir.
Mm.
They say La ilaha illallah,
mm.
they pray.
Yeah.
Anybody who denies this aspect of Islam is like denying all of Islam.
So
why are you denying that part of it?
Mm.
Why
it's
you
a very interesting question.
Right? So, again, not all enemies are the same. Not all people whose final agenda is not Islam are going to approach it in a certain manner. You have people who have a lesser degree of issues, who have greater degrees
of
problems
issues,
and issues in their conduct and
mm.
in their beliefs.
True.
So it doesn't mean that you treat all of them exactly the same way. It doesn't mean that your reaction to them is all the same.
And you have to be very sophisticated in how
you. But you have to understand who the enemy is.
Is.
You have to understand.
At all levels.
And you have to understand who it is that really wants Islam as the goal.
Exactly.
And not just any Islam, the Islam of their nafs.
Uh-huh.
It's the Islam of Ahlul Bayt.
Because remember, this is very interesting because this does go back to something we've spoken about previously. That, you know, it was very interesting how Imam, and God bless his great soul, honestly, I mean, I was thrown by this all the time in the Western press. That he talked about, you know, Muhammadan Islam And then he talked about American Islam.
Exactly.
And I couldn't figure out what he meant. America, I mean, America, you know,
right.
If you know anything about America, you can't associate the word Islam with it. But, you know, he said that there's
Listen,
two different types.
He said it at some point.
Yeah.
And places. He said they want an Islam in which there's no jihad, where there's no qisas.
It's like half
you know,
all the
where,
stuff is
where
thrown
all
out.
Those issues relating to you know, marital relations and ethical matters that are relates to
yeah.
the relationship between
yeah, just
man
having
and
a wee wash
and family and all that are all out of it. That's
yes.
the kind of Islam they want.
Yes. Which basically means
you
just
know,
chuck it away.
Right. So he's saying that this you know, it's not even his opinion. He's saying
no,
in
no,
the Quran says you can't.
You can't.
It's a package.
Yeah.
It's a package deal.
It's throwing the baby out of the bathwater.
It's a package
it?
Deal.
Hmm.
It's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, all or nothing, not in the sense that we are able to implement everything in our lives. We have different
capacities. Yes.
You know, there's a very big, you know that Islamic, according to Islamic law, this is a very important point, and I really would like our listeners to really pay attention to this.
Please,
there's
please.
A big, big difference.
Hmm.
There's a world of difference. According to Islamic law, between somebody who says, let me just, there's two kind of people I'm going to mention.
Please.
The first person says, I don't deny Islamic law. I don't deny that there is prayer five times. I don't deny that there is fasting during the month of Ramadan, etc., etc., etc. But I am not, I don't have the power to do it, or I'm not capable of doing it.
Mm. That's true. There's
there's a difference between a person who says this and a person who says, no, there is no prayer. I believe in God, but there really isn't. This was just
Very
something
good.
That was in the Quran,
Excellent.
You know, whatever, or you guys made it up from the riwayat.
Yes, sure.
Or, you know, whatever, the fasting. No, there is God, the Prophet was. But, you know, this fasting thing, well, this was in the old days when people didn't have doctors. Or, you know, this kind of stuff that we hear. There's a world of difference between these two.
Two people, yes.
The first one, no problem.
No problem.
No problem.
No.
It really...
No.
The only problem that person has is with himself and God.
With his God,
He's
yes.
not denying it.
He's not denying anything. Absolutely.
He's just saying, I'm
Wonderful.
Weak. I can't do it. Or, you know...
Yeah, there's some difficulty.
Right. You know, this is completely different than somebody who's going to deny
the very essence of it.
The essence of it. Even though they might say, you know, La ilaha illallah.
But that's the whole point,
the
isn't
point
it? This is the point that we are
right,
arriving at.
It's not
at.
About saying it.
No.
Only. It's about the consequences.
Consequences
of
what's being
okay.
said.
So when he says, "Yo, no, you know, I believe in God. Of course there's a God." Because, you know, you hear this. Like, oh,
I
know. There's God. You know, who, very few people actually deny
God.
Right, you know?
I think since the outset of humanity, they haven't denied.
Right,
even
we're talking about in Islamic communities and societies,
Absolutely.
Very few people will
deny
it,
that
or say no, the Prophet
no,
wasn't
no.
the Prophet. It's when it comes to the consequences of saying La ilaha illallah
yes.
Muhammad Rasulullah, you know,
this is
that's what it comes down to,
and that's what the Imams are referring to, exactly.
Right. So here we have Imam Khomeini, as we mentioned previously, fearless.
I mean,
and you
wonderful.
Know, really fearless, not like you
no,
know,
no.
show fearless and
no,
you know,
no, no,
showing off.
Brave as because he's you know, really safe,
right?
You know, I mean, come on, let's get things
right.
into
number one,
here.
Number two, completely distinguishing haq from batil without any sort of you know, wishy washiness.
Thank you.
Okay, no wishy washiness.
No wishy washiness.
Okay, because we have that in the culture and we have that.
No,
among
we've
the
seen it for the last 1400
and it's,
years.
And it's you know, it's a kind of creeping way of nifaq. It's a kind of creeping nifaq.
It is. It's a creeping nifaq. Very nicely put. It's an engineering term. I can see it now. Creeping nifaq. I could do a formula for that.
Exactly.
Yes,
please
you.
Figure out the formula.
I will. I will. I'll
creeping
let you know.
Nifaq, so
I certainly will let you know on
right?
this program.
The third thing we're mentioning now is the fact that he was very keen and, how should I say, he was very precise and very exact and very capable of distinguishing the enemy, distinguishing who's trying to fool him and who's really being honest and sincere.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
with the sentence that we mentioned, which is that even if Israel and even if America and Israel say La ilaha illallah, we won't believe them.
Exactly.
Because they're trying to fool us.
Yes.
Okay? And what we're trying to say here is that this relates to you as a Muslim individually and as a community, as it relates to outside enemies
Absolutely.
That are clear,
mm-hmm.
and as it relates to nifaq within the Muslim community. There are, you know, that's the whole point of a Muslim.
This is the greatest danger that we as believers
right?
face.
Because obviously being within the Islamic community means you've said La ilaha illallah Muhammadan Rasulullah.
Allah?
Right? So the point is, you know, who's being honest?
Who's being honest?
Who's accepting?
Who's sincere in terms
who's
of
being
his
who's accepting the consequences of that? Okay, and we see in the history of Imam and in what he did, Imam Khomeini, you had people within the revolutionary movement, within the so-called Islamic tent, and they were saying it, and yet they were after the opposite. And he was able to distinguish them. At a time when people were like, well, you know, we have the Shah as the enemy, well, let's not, you know, why are you being so? And he's like, no, he could see the result of what they're saying, you know, 30 years down the road.
The road, exactly.
Because he understood Islam, because he was a student of Quran. And in the Quran, it teaches you all these things.
Wonderful.
Okay? If you read the Quran and not just read it as hips or as trying to just parrot-wise, you know?
No, no.
Parrot-like fashion.
No.
Where you actually
that
ponder.
That Hibs is living it.
Right. It's the pondering on it, the thinking about it, the you know, it going into your soul and it becoming something that then you use in your life.
Exactly.
In order to be able to distinguish the issues and the challenges.
The truth and false.
Right. This is where Imam comes from.
Exactly.
And this is where we have to also try to get ourselves and to come from that position.
Dr. Mati Charabi, thank you very much. And on that note, we'll end the program. But wonderful. Absolutely wonderful in terms of that insight about the Imam. God bless his great soul. We miss him. And I just like to thank our listeners for listening to the program. I hope they benefited from what we had to say today. And it just leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Qiyana in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Those who have been listening to this series of shows, they are quite familiar with the current that we have. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions that we receive from different questioners from around the world. And for that, we invite Islamic researchers, scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. As usual, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karmi, Islamic researcher and scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, to help us in this show. He is the guest of us in this studio. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is concerning the memorization of the Holy Quran. We have seen that, and we see that in Islam world, many people like to memorize the words and the verses of Holy Quran, the words of God in our, let's say, common interpretation of what the memorization and what the verses of the Quran like. Look, it is very beautiful to memorize, and this is a very good chance for those memorizers of the Holy Quran. But let's ask that, what is the importance of memorizing the whole Quran, and why are we Muslims actually emphasize on the memorization of the Holy Quran? Is it a must or just a mustahab or recommended action? Is it mandatory or recommended? This is one aspect of it that we want you to explain about that, Sheikh. Second, is it good to encourage our kids, our sons, our daughters to go towards memorizing the Holy Quran and to actually refrain them from going to know what Quran is saying rather than memorizing it? So I'd be thankful if you answer this question in detail.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are, when it comes to the Noble Book of Quran, we have different approaches. I mean, sometimes you recite the Quran. I mean, even sometimes you just look at the Quran without reciting. Sometimes you recite the Quran. Sometimes you try to understand the Quran and then acting upon the Quran. For sure, acting upon the Quran is the most important one, which requires, of course, understanding the Quran. But it doesn't mean that, looking at the Quran, reciting the Quran, and then memorizing the Quran, they have no value. According to the many narrations that we have received from the infallibles, the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, even looking at the pages of the Quran and the verses is an act of worship. More important than that is reciting the Quran, and the next stage is memorizing the Quran. So,
true.
The fact that some people memorize the Quran and do not act upon it should not lead us to this wrong conclusion that so memorizing the Quran has no value. I mean, even many Khawarij who began a war against Imam alayhi salam, they may memorize the whole Quran.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, their understanding of the Quran was wrong understanding.
Sheikh, let's sorry for interruption. Let's start with the first point that I ask you to elaborate on. That is, what is the importance of it? Is it due to that our we are frightened that Quran might be, let's say, distorted or to be lost? This is the reason that we are actually encouraging people to go towards memorization of the Holy Quran, or no? This is due to some other reason.
When we refer to the narrations, at least we may find more than 15 benefits which are mentioned for, as the positive points for memorizing the Quran.
Yeah.
And if I have time, inshallah, I will quickly refer to all of them. But what you mentioned is a reality. One of the reasons that Quran, according to many scholars, remain intact without any distortion and alteration is the fact that Muslims, generation after generation, they memorized the Quran and also they wrote down the verses of the Quran. Only in one, one of the Sariyas at the time of the Prophet, which means a war in which the Holy Prophet himself was not present, which is known as the event of Bi'r Ma'una, it is mentioned that about 40 pe- I